part of it is to reorient or realign our concept of the world, both social and emotional world around us. The Greek word poesis, meaning to make, is the idea of creation, and what poets make is metaphor or association. So that I think of the work of poets being very orderly, but not necessarily logical.
Poet and critic John Gary, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. John Gary is here to read from and talk about his work. His new collection of poems is entitled The Enemies of Leisure.
This is the first poem in my book, and it's an important poem to me because of the way that it introduces the idea of ghosts, who I think are important in our culture, though often not seen or not thought about, and also have something to do with the role that the poet plays with us. Also, there's a sense that there's a conversation going on here with a very famous line from William Carlos Williams, "No ideas but in things." American ghosts. Not quite so collapsible as you may imagine, these bones of the fundamental country. They hold up loosely within the spirit, the American ghost. Fit like an elegant shirt around a clean, lapidary body, so you can see they are cut from the same cloth. No things without the ideas we call them by, when comes the time to bless and eat. We ingest neatly the white corn. We inhale after that the air. And swallowing whole hog what we have been given, we stroll out into the open, even if no one else notices us. The field itself we are crossing, much like any other field, fallow for yielding us its rich future after a rest. And we are assured by our very invisibility, pressed deep into our flesh, of ourselves, footloose and bravely unseen, yet thought of all the same.
John Gary is a professor of English at the University of New Orleans. His new book is a collection of poems entitled The Enemies of Leisure. It explores an important individual and social struggle of modern mass culture. This is the tension between labor and leisure, a variation on one of poetry's enduring themes, namely the philosophical search for meanings of happiness. But John Gary's poetry is anything but abstract. Instead, by using concrete images from Middle America, it draws us into a world of shifting, even contradictory moods that give shape and substance to the details of our lives. With another reading from his new book of poems, here again is John Gary.
This poem is set in Jackson Square, or the opening part of it, which is at the center of the French Quarter in New Orleans. The Enemies of Leisure. At Jackson Square last Saturday at noon, the enemies of leisure sat down on a park bench to plot their strategy against my turgescent idleness. One of them, the one with green skin whose veins bulge around his eyes, reached forward and down to pick up pieces of stale bread I'd left for the pigeons, and the wood on the bench warped under the sweating thighs of the rest of the enemies of leisure. I heard a butterfly crying, or was it a disfigured moth? Another one, the enemy of leisure with the red scrubbed hands, lifted lint from the overcoat of a nearby sleeping vagrant as I gathered in my newspapers and started to rise. And sweeping the sidewalks with his yellowed eyes, the one with pimples called out, "Almost Sunday," he cried. They know much better the label to put on a pretty day than I do, the enemies of leisure. They work at it. I am a small miracle, and I know nothing. I have nothing to do. But to some I am a giant, and last night the enemies of leisure, all seven of them, marched in single file up the side of my bedpost, over my feet, and across my legs, leaving tracks of purpose deep in my blankets, burning the hair on my chest in their wake, then chopping back my sideburns to bury landmines under my temples. Today I tried memorizing Whitman. I lean and loaf at my ease, etc. And, as to you, death, your bitter hug of mortality, it is idle to try to alarm me. And so on. But it was no defense, and I am fading, I am fading. The black-caped leader of the enemies of leisure scaled my green scheflera to direct his attack from its leaves. Like Tu Fu, I drank wine from a white cup, but it's no go. I am losing my fortitude. I am asking you to visit me. The enemies of leisure are shoveling the dust out from underneath my slippers. The one in the brown three-piece suit is crawling up my arm now, making small entries on a clipboard. His pencil is sharpened. His eraser has never been used. His prognosis is grim. I repeat, I am dying. SOS, come to me quickly. You are my only chance. I will save for you the tracks of purpose and the warm wine, abandoning ship. This may be the last letter you receive from me that has no point to it.
John, who are the enemies of leisure?
Well, the enemies of leisure are, for me, figures who have been, you know, under my craw for a long time. In the poem of that name in the book, they take the shape of very small figures mm-hmm. who will not let me relax on a Sunday in the center of the French Quarter, a beautiful afternoon, the time when you think you should be able to relax.
Are we talking about the poetic muse here? Should we be that grandiose, or how mundane should we be?
Well, the muse is itself a very complex issue because there are nine muses at least, and they take so many different shapes. But for me, this conflict between labor and leisure is one that I think poets, at least for me, is a constant thing. We think of poetry as not exactly entertainment,
right?
But also not exactly labor, not mm-hmm. exactly work, but something that lies between, which probably is life itself. So if the enemies of leisure are these figures who prompt you to write poetry, they don't certainly have the romantic image of at least the muse that the muse has had in the last 200 years or so
right.
as someone who is supposed to seduce you into writing art or creating art or writing poetry.
How do you think of yourself connecting to all of those dead poets back there on the horizon, whether they are white and male or regardless of skin color or gender? You create yourself as a poet. I mean, that's part of the fun that you have, working with words and doing the work of the poet. And my guess is here that you are also thinking about, to use a phrase here, American ghosts, American and otherwise. You're mm-hmm. looking back at all these other poets. How do they work in your mind?
Mm-hmm. I think really that poets are having conversations with each other so that as many of my readers are those who I would have read me or who to whom I am responding from my reading
right.
as they are breathing human beings walking around.
Does that mean that poets are talking only to one another? Part of the criticism or part of the weakness of poetry, part of the role of poetry in our mass culture is that it's too much of an internal conversation, that you're not really connecting out there with this wider world.
Again, the problem I have with that is the assumption that it was otherwise at some other point.
Uh-huh.
And I don't really think that's true. When I'm a teacher, and when I first started to teach, I felt as though my job was to convert all my students to love poetry. And of course, most of them resented me for having that assumption, either that they didn't already or right. that this is something important to them. And conversion is not, to me, as important as exposure.
Uh-huh.
The conversation among those who read poetry is it works in time differently, so that those who are not reading it now are not, at least it's available to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's different now that because so many more people can read. Byron was an extremely popular poet,
right?
But I don't know that he had as many readers as, you know, most poets writing today in terms of sheer numbers, because there were so many fewer people who could read. So I think it's important not to worry too much about those questions, but to talk to the people who are part of your kind. It's an important word to me.
Fair enough.
And then to try to explore who those people are.
John, what makes you a poet in the sense of the artistic work of the poet? It is a truism that you poets are in love with language, mm-hmm. that you like to play with words and take them apart and put them back together again. How do you know when you are composing, so to speak, that a poem is a poem? My question involves a little contentiousness here. I go to a poetry slam, somebody stands up with a piece of paper that he or she has written 20 minutes beforehand and spiels off these lines, and everybody applauds and says, wow, that's a poem. How do you feel about that? I mean, how do you work at being a poet?
Well, for me, it has to do with leisure again. It has to do with play.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, play is a very serious thing. And work needs to be approached with a certain amount of levity, so that the language leads us in that direction. Because we live in a culture that whose language is so predominant around the world, we tend to assume that that language is very stable and powerful. And what I've learned from reading the poetry, sometimes in English, of cultures not so dominant, is how that playfulness that the poets participate in mm-hmm. helps keep the language alive and helps preserve it, but also helps to shape what is going to be preserved.
Is writing poetry for you, John, is it essentially a joyous and joyful activity? Is it a form of labor in the sense that once you get that impulse out and you have a body of words to work with there on the page or the computer screen, then you have to go back and make it poetry, so to speak, with rhyme and meter and subtleties and all of those things that, all those technicalities that the critics will either praise or damn you for?
Yeah, I think it doesn't quite work, again, quite that way in terms of the separation of it, uh-huh. that the technical aspects are part of the way that it is put together, and that becomes the labor. But it's, I think of a story of that a teacher of mine told me about, I think it was Richard Wilbur, who, when my teacher went to visit him one afternoon in Connecticut, he found Wilbur sitting in a tree. I hope this is the right story, but it's apocryphal anyway. And he was sitting in a tree, gloriously happy because he had come up with the right rhyme to end his poem. And this is what made it pleasurable for him.
Well, that's okay. Some people will take lawnmowers out and other people will go out and dig in their gardens. So you got poets who like to sit in trees. Didn't William Blake do the same thing?
Yes. Yeah. And many other things like that. But it was a central part of the creation of the poem itself. It's finding that pleasure. I think that those poets at the Poetry Slam are in pursuit of the same kind of unity of feeling mm-hmm. and expression.
So you don't look down your nose at this kind of thing. I mean, that condescension is not a word in your vocabulary when you look at what the aspiring poets or the amateur poets.
I don't think it's appropriate. I mean, egalitarianism is available to us through the language, uh-huh. and part of the attraction to me in writing poetry is that kind of benefit. Whitman predicted
right.
a century of poets who would be like priests right. in the 20th century.
The citizen poet.
Yes.
The democracy with a little d, and everybody's a participant and a poet in that grand scenario.
Yes, and it's through the bond that the language provides for us, that uh-huh. each of us can shape language. I have two middle names. It doesn't cost any more to have two middle names than to have one.
Fair enough.
You know, so that, and there's no there's no built-in elitism in the way that you learn to use language. There's only need for opportunity.
Uh-huh. John, we've been talking about your collection here, The Enemies of Leisure. Let's turn our attention to the book of criticism that you have just recently published. This is called Nuclear Annihilation and Contemporary American Poetry. Now, there's some pretty serious heavy lifting going on in that title.
Yes.
Why should poets be concerned any more than anybody else in this country about nuclear annihilation? What do poets have to say to this issue that might otherwise go unsaid?
I think that they shouldn't be more concerned than anyone else, but I don't think they should be any less concerned. And that such a threat that exists around us, and I think it still exists around us, mm-hmm. Requires that each of us within our capacity come to terms with it in some way. And my reading has certainly borne that out in that poets, almost every poet I've read, at some point or other feels as though he or she needs to come to terms with this presence, this absence, or this presence of absence within our day-to-day lives. The fact that our day-to-day lives could almost instantaneously be, if not eradicated, totally or entirely altered. And for poets who are attempting to be sensitive to the daily experience of living, whether it's domestic or spiritual, this plays a big part of it. And that their idea, their function is to bring to it that sense of making metaphor or finding expression for those experiences.
Would you say, John, that poets bear a special moral responsibility in addition to their aesthetic duties, the work, again, of the poet? Do they bear a special moral responsibility, the unacknowledged legislator and the sort of conscience of a nation in their poetic work when it comes to a profoundly serious subject like nuclear annihilation?
I wouldn't want to dictate that to poets, mm-hmm. but I certainly think that...
Or have them dictate it to us.
Or not to have them dictate it to us. Uh-huh. But I think that there are plenty of poets who find it within themselves as part of their project of creating a sense of the world to take on that kind of moral problem, if not to become morally responsible for it.
Is there an arrogance at work here? On the one end, you would have the sort of a humble poet working at his or her craft. On the other hand, you have, as I say, a kind of an implied arrogance at work here, telling us how to think about a subject like nuclear annihilation. Isn't that the work of the politicians and the teachers?
Well, why is their arrogance somehow more credible than someone else's? I don't think of it as arrogance. Uh-huh. I think of it as doing one's job,
right?
And presenting a way of thinking about the world, as I try to argue in the book, that is as valid a way of thinking, although it might not be part of the mass culture that you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That should be made available as ways of thinking. Why is it that someone who is a military expert has or an industrial expert should have the corner on how we think about living with uh-huh. a change that has been true now for about 50 years?
So what is the message of the poet in the age of the potential for nuclear annihilation? We're talking of something analogous, for example, to what the artists do when it comes to, again, a serious subject like the Holocaust. We shouldn't forget. Is that what the whole thing comes down to?
Of course we shouldn't forget. And the poets themselves, being always individualists, don't agree with each other mm-hmm. about what we should all be thinking. That's how it doesn't dictate quite. But there is an important conversation going on among a range of poets about how to rethink from the point of how to oppose those who feel otherwise. Mm-hmm. The more outspoken or assertive poets, as I argue in the book, take the position of protesting what is currently the status quo, whether it's pre or post Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And the other extreme of this spectrum, or the other side of the spectrum, is the poets who take on that way of thinking and try to see how it functions in our ways of thinking about ourselves. So it's less overtly political, and more in terms of constructions of thinking.
So this is really, at the one end of the scale, it is a very social issue, but what I hear you saying is that the relationship of poetry to a serious subject like nuclear weapons is, after all, a profoundly personal experience that's at work here.
Absolutely, yes. And I think together with concepts of gender and the confusion and redefinition of racial identity, that this way of redefining our relationship to the kind of technology that nuclear power represents are the most profoundly personal item or profoundly personal aspects of late 20th century life.
Should I accuse you of being politically correct, dragging gender and race into an issue, into a conversation about nuclear annihilation in poetry?
But I didn't say anything correct about them. I just said that they're there. What I think about them is what I have to struggle with for myself, as does everyone else. But I don't think we can avoid it. I don't think that I can avoid looking in the mirror and seeing the color of my skin. Mm-hmm. And I certainly can't avoid moving around in this country or living in cities and not noticing the way that nuclear power and nuclear weaponry has altered the landscape.
Mm-hmm. John, is it fanciful to think that poets, again, in the kind of delicate work that they do, the hard artistic work that they do, the hard thinking that they do about serious subjects, is it unrealistic or naive of me to think that poets and poetry can do anything to get us off the dime and to move away from the threat of nuclear annihilation? Or is it, again, the sort of sports department of life, and we'll indulge them at coffee houses, and you can publish your books and your criticism, but it really has no effect in the wide, real world?
I think if each of us thinks about how change has occurred in the inside of our lives, in our ways of perceiving the world, that becomes the paradigm for how poetry interacts with the culture around it. It comes through the process of redefining or introducing new words, or in fact preserving old words that may be fading from the language, and that it's not easy to put a measure on it. And if you're in a culture that's demanding that kind of measure, it's even harder to put a measure on it. But that does not mean that it's not there. And I would say that's akin to the ghosts. You know, you cannot prove to me that there are no ghosts sitting with us right now, even though I can't prove that there are. Mm-hmm. But we do know the term.
Right. They may not be little Caspers sitting here at our elbows, but they're in our minds. Right. The weight of the past upon us.
That's right. That's right. And they have an influence on how we think because we are conscious of them. And I think poets certainly traditionally have had that kind of impact. I mean, Dante in Italy or Chaucer in England have been major figures in the way people think, and that our poets are doing the same, even if we're not constantly, why should we be constantly aware of what they're doing? But they're influencing the language.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to give me a quick answer to an impossible question, John. Can you teach poetry? I mean, not in the sense of, here's Chaucer, here's Shakespeare's sonnets. Can you actually tell somebody how to write a poem?
You can't tell them how to write a poem, but you can bring them all the tools and tell them what some of those tools can do and show them lots of examples of people digging in that garden using those tools, and then give them the option. Do you want to use a rake? Do you want to use a hoe? You can't teach someone to play tennis, but if you don't teach them how to hold a racket, they might have a little trouble getting the ball over the net. And I think poetry works the same way. I think that the idea that you can't teach poetry is that which is mostly held by people who don't practice it very much and don't know the work that's involved, the way that there's work involved in anything.
John Gary teaches at the University of New Orleans. His recent books include a collection of poems entitled The Enemies of Leisure, published by Storyline Press. John Gary is also the author of a critical study entitled Nuclear Annihilation and Contemporary American Poetry, available from the University Press of Florida. He's at work on a new collection of poems entitled Ghosts and Promiscuities, and a narrative poem about the Civil War entitled Davenport's Version. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. Before that, with another reading from his poetry, here again is John Gary.
I often find myself writing poems in sequence, even when I try to avoid it. And one of the ideas of poetry that's interesting to me is to take abstract terms, not obscure ones, but common ones that we apply in everyday life, and to give them some kind of image or shape. And this is one of the earlier ones of that series called The Shape of Sadness. This sadness, like an evergreen dying, keeps its common shape as it turns brown and brittle, biding its time. It will not lift. It will not tear its roots from underground, nor drop its needled branches hard and dry, nor splinter from some woodsman's searing saw clearing the forest. It has taken years to settle. Now its slow descent claims all. You may not note the differences at first. Its shades the same, the wrinkles on its bark peel off as effortlessly, streaks of sap still promise sweetness inside. The odd lark who finds a place for nesting here rejoices. Only the shade may somehow seem less cool, the bark less pliable, the sap not so clear. The lark's shrill call, less gentle, and then cruel.
You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was poet and critic John Gary. Audio cassettes are available for $10 post-paid. Please write to us for a tape or send us your comments. The address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 844. That's $10, program number 844. The address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, The South Explained. John Shelton Reed and Dale Volberg Reed will be here to talk about their new book, 1001 Things Everyone Should Know About the South. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.